the crisis. Exactly 8 years from the day when the embattled farmers stood and fired the shot heard round the world, the Continental Congress informed General Washington that the war was over. In September 1783, the formal treaty of peace was signed. A month later, the Continental Army was disbanded, and 3 weeks later, the British Army sailed from New York. What a pathetic and impressive scene took place at a little tavern in Lower New York when Washington said goodbye to his generals. With hearts too full for words and with eyes dimmed with tears, these veterans embraced their chief and bade him farewell. A few days before Christmas, Washington gave up the command of the army and hurried away to spend the holidays at Mount Vernon. "The times that tried men's souls are over," wrote the author of Common Sense, a man whose writings voiced the opinions of the people. Freedom was indeed won, but the country was in a sad plight. "It is not too much to say," says John Fiske, "that the period of 5 years following the peace of 1783 was the most critical moment in all the history of the American people. 13 little republics fringing the Atlantic were hemmed in on the north, the south, and the west by 2 hostile European nations that were capable of much mischief. In 1774, under the pressure of a common peril and the need of quick action, the colonies had banded together for the common good. By a kind of general consent, their representatives in the Continental Congress had assumed the task of carrying on the war. But for 9 years, Congress had steadily declined in power, and now that peace had come and the need of united action was removed, there was danger that this shadowy union would dissolve. Believing strongly in their own state governments, the people had almost no feeling in favor of federation. Just before the disbanding of the army and his retirement to private life, Washington wrote a letter to the governor of each colony. This letter, he said, was his legacy to the American people. He urged the necessity of forming a more perfect union under a single government. He declared that the war debt must be paid to the last penny, that the people must be willing to sacrifice some of their local interests for the common good, and that they must regard one another as fellow citizens of a common country. "We must not make the mistake of thinking that the Continental Congress was like our present National Congress. When the struggle between the colonies and the mother country threatened war, the colonies, through their assemblies or special conventions, chose delegates to represent them in Philadelphia. These delegates composed the First Continental Congress. It met on September 5th, 1774, and broke up during the last week of the following October. 3 weeks after Lexington, a second Congress met in the same city. This was the Congress that appointed Washington Commander-in-Chief and issued the immortal Declaration of Independence. In the strict sense of the word, this body had no legal authority. It was really a meeting of delegates from the several colonies to advise and consult with each other concerning the public welfare. There was war in the land. Something must be done to meet the crisis. The Continental Congress, therefore, acted in the name of the United Colonies. Many of the ablest and most patriotic men of the country were sent as delegates to this Congress, and until the crowning victory at Yorktown, although without clearly defined powers, it continued to act, by common consent, as if it had the highest authority. It made an alliance with France. It built a navy. It granted permits to privateers. It raised and organized an army. It borrowed large sums of money and issued paper bills. A few days after the Declaration of Independence was signed, a form of government called the Articles of Confederation was brought before Congress, but it was not adopted until several weeks after the surrender of Burgoyne in 1777. The Articles were not finally ratified by the states until the spring of 1781. The Constitution thus adopted was a league of friendship between the states. It was bad from beginning to end, for it dealt with the 13 states as 13 units and not with the people of the several states. It never secured a hold upon the people of the country, and for very good reasons. Each state, whether large or small, had only one vote. A single delegate from Delaware or from Rhode Island could balance the whole delegation from New York or from Virginia. Congress had no power to enforce any law whatever. It could recommend all manner of things to the states, but it could do nothing more. It could not even protect itself. Hence, the states violated the articles whenever they pleased. Thus, Congress might call for troops, but the states could refuse to obey. Without the consent of every state, not a dollar could be raised by taxation. At one time, 12 states voted to allow Congress to raise money to pay the soldiers, but little Rhode Island flatly refused, and the plan failed. The next year, Rhode Island consented, but New York refused. Although Congress had authority to coin money, to issue bills of credit, and to make its notes legal tender for debts, each one of the 13 states had the same authority. Money affairs got into a wretched condition. Paper money became almost worthless. The year after Saratoga, a paper dollar was worth only 16 cents, and early in 1780 its value had fallen to 2 cents. A trader in Philadelphia papered his shop with dollar bills to show what he thought of the flimsy stuff. In the year of Cornwallis' surrender, a bushel of corn sold for $150, and Samuel Adams, the Boston Patriot, had to pay $2,000 for a hat and a suit of clothes. A private soldier had to serve 4 months before his pay would buy a bushel of wheat. When he could not collect this beggarly sum, is it any wonder that he deserted or rebelled? At one time, being unable to get money for the army, Congress asked the states to contribute supplies of corn, pork, and hay. To add to the general misery, the states began to quarrel with one another, like a lot of schoolboys. They almost came to bloodshed over boundary lines and levied the most absurd taxes and duties. If a Connecticut farmer brought a load of firewood into New York, he had to pay a heavy duty. Sloops that sailed through Hell Gate and Jersey market boats that crossed to Manhattan Island were treated as if from foreign ports. Entrance fees had to be paid, and clearance papers must be got at the custom house. The country was indeed in a bad condition. There were riots, bankruptcy, endless wranglings, foreclosed mortgages, and imprisonment for debt. The gallant Colonel Barton, who captured General Prescott, was kept locked up because he could not pay a small sum of money. Robert Morris, once a wealthy merchant, was sent to jail for debt, although he had given his whole fortune to the patriot cause. Thoughtful and patriotic men and women throughout the country felt that something must be done. Washington and other far-sighted men of Virginia began to work out the problem. First, it was proposed that delegates from 2 or 3 states should meet at Annapolis to discuss the question of trade. Finally, all the states were invited to send delegates. At this meeting, only 12 delegates from 5 states were present. Alexander Hamilton wrote an eloquent address, which it was voted to send to the state assemblies, strongly recommending that delegates should be appointed to meet at Philadelphia on the second day of May, 1787. This plan, however, Congress promptly rejected. During the winter of 1786, the times were perhaps even harder and the country nearer to the brink of civil war and ruin. There were riots in New Hampshire and in Vermont, and Shays' Rebellion in the Old Bay State. There were also the threatened separation of the northern and southern states, the worthless paper money, wildcat speculation, the failure to carry out certain provisions of the Treaty of Peace, and many troubles of less importance. As we may well suppose, all this discord made King George and his court happy. He declared that the several states would soon repent and beg on bended knees to be taken back into the British Empire. When it was predicted in Parliament that we should become a great nation, a British statesman who bore us no ill will said, "It is one of the idlest and most visionary notions that was ever conceived even by a writer of romance." Frederick the Great was friendly to us, but he declared that nobody but a king could ever rule so large a country. All these unhappy events produced a great change in public opinion. People were convinced that anarchy might be worse than the union of these 13 little commonwealths under a strong central government. At this great crisis in affairs, Virginia boldly took the lead and promptly sent 7 of her ablest citizens, one of whom was Washington, to the Philadelphia Convention. This was a masterly stroke of policy. People everywhere applauded, and the tide of popular sentiment soon favored the convention. At last, Congress yielded to the voice of the people and approved the plan. Every state except Rhode Island sent delegates. It was a notable group of Americans that met in one of the upper rooms of Old Independence Hall the last week of May 1787. There were 55 delegates in all, some of whom, however, did not arrive for several weeks after the convention began its meetings. 8 of the delegates had signed the Declaration of Independence in the same room. 28 had been members of the Continental Congress, and 7 had been governors of states. 2 afterwards became presidents of the United States, and many others in after years filled high places in the national government. Head and shoulders above all others towered George Washington. The man most widely known, except Washington, was Benjamin Franklin, 81 years old. The youngest delegate was Mr. Dayton of New Jersey, who was only 26. Here also were 2 of the ablest statesmen of their time, Alexander Hamilton of New York and James Madison of Virginia. Connecticut sent 2 of her great men, Oliver Ellsworth, afterwards Chief Justice of the United States, and Roger Sherman, the learned shoemaker. Near Robert Morris, the great financier, sat his namesake, Governor Morris, who originated our decimal system of money, and James Wilson, one of the most learned lawyers of his day. The 2 brilliant Pinckneys and John Rutledge, the silver-tongued orator, were there to represent South Carolina. Then there were Elbridge Gerry and Rufus King of Massachusetts, John Langdon of New Hampshire, John Dickinson of Delaware, and the great orator Edmund Randolph of Virginia. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams would no doubt have been delegates had they not been abroad in the service of their country. Patrick Henry and Samuel Adams remained at home, for they did not approve of the convention. How Rhode Island must have missed her most eminent citizen, Nathaniel Greene, who had just died of sunstroke in the prime of manhood. Washington was elected president of the convention. The doors were locked, and every member being pledged to secrecy, they settled down to work. Just what was said and done during those 4 months was for more than 50 years kept a profound secret. After the death of James Madison, often called the father of the Constitution, his journal was published, giving a complete account of the proceedings. When the delegates began their work, they soon realized what a problem it was to frame a government for the whole country. As might have been expected, some of these men had a fit of moral cowardice. They began to cut and to trim and tried to avoid any measure of thorough reform. Washington was equal to the occasion. He was not a brilliant orator, and his speech was very brief, but the solemn words of this majestic man, as his tall figure drawn up to its full height rose from the president's chair, carried conviction to every delegate. "If, to please the people," he said, "we offer what we ourselves disapprove, how can we afterward defend our work? Let us raise a standard to which the wise and the honest can repair. The event is in the hand of God." The details of what this convention did would be dull reading, But someday we shall want to study in our schoolwork the noble constitution which these men framed. The gist of the whole matter is that our federal constitution is based upon three great compromises. The first compromise was between the small and the large states. In the upper house, or Senate, equal representation was conceded to all the states. But in the lower house of Congress, representation was arranged according to the population. Thus, as you know, Little Rhode Island and Delaware each have two senators, while the great commonwealths of New York and Ohio have no more. In the House of Representatives, on the other hand, New York has 37 representatives and Ohio has 21, while Rhode Island has two and Delaware only one. The second compromise was between the free and the slave states. Were the slaves to be counted as persons or as goods? South Carolina and Georgia maintained that they were persons. The northern states said they were merely property. Now, indeed, there was a clashing over local interests, but it was decided that in counting the population, whether for taxation or for representation in the lower house, a slave should be considered as 3/5 of an individual. And so it stood until the outbreak of the Civil War. It was a bitter pill for far-sighted men like Washington, Madison, and others who hated slavery. Without this compromise, however, they believed that 9 slave states would never adopt the Constitution, and doubtless they were right. The slave question was the real bone of contention that resulted in the third compromise. The majority of the delegates, especially those from Virginia, were bitterly opposed to slavery. "This infernal traffic that brings the judgment of heaven on a country," said George Mason of Virginia. At first, it was proposed to abolish foreign slave trade. South Carolina and Georgia sturdily protested. "Are we wanted in the Union?" they said. They declared that it was not a question of morality or of religion, but purely a matter of business. Rhode Island had refused to send delegates, and those from New York had gone home in anger. The discussions were bitter, and the situation became dangerous. While the convention was scarcely held together by the strength of a hair, the question came up for discussion whether Congress or the individual state should have control over commerce. The New England states, with their wealth of shipping, said that by all means Congress should have the control and should make a uniform tariff in all the states. This, it was believed, would put an end to all the wranglings and the unjust acts which were so ruinous to commerce. The extreme southern states that had no shipping said it would never do, for New England, by controlling the carrying trade, would extort ruinous prices for shipping tobacco and rice. When the outlook seemed darkest, 2 of the Connecticut delegates suggested a compromise. "Yes," said Franklin, "when a carpenter wishes to fit 2 boards, he sometimes pairs off a bit from each end." It was finally decided that there should be free trade between the states, and that Congress should control commerce. To complete the bargain, nothing was to be done about the African slave trade for 20 years. Slavery had been slowly dying out both in the North and in the South for nearly 50 years. The wisest men of 1787 believed that it would speedily die a natural death and give way to a better system of labor. It was upon these 3 great foundation stones, or compromises, that our Constitution was built. The rest of the work, while very important, was not difficult or dangerous. The question of choosing a president and 100 other less important matters were at last settled. The scorching summer of 1787 was well nigh spent before the great document was finished. The convention broke up on September 17th. Few of its members were satisfied with their work. None supposed it complete. Tradition says that Washington, who was the first to sign, standing by the table, held up his pen and said solemnly, "Should the states reject this excellent constitution, they probably will never sign another in peace. The next will be drawn in blood." Of the delegates who were present on the last day of the convention, all but three signed the Constitution. It is said that when the last man had signed, many of the delegates seemed awestruck at what they had done. Washington himself sat with head bowed in deep thought. 33 years before this, and before some of the delegates then present were born, Franklin had done his best to bring the colonies into a federal union. He was 60 years of age when, in this very room, he put his name to the Declaration of Independence. Now, as the genial old man saw the noble aim of his life accomplished, he indulged in one of his homely bits of pleasantry. There was a rude painting of a half-sun, gorgeous with its yellow rays, on the back of the president's black armchair. When Washington solemnly rose, as the meeting was breaking up, Franklin pointed at the chair and said, "As I have been sitting here all these weeks, I have often wondered whether the sun behind our president is rising or setting. Now I do know that it is a rising sun." The Constitution was sent to the Continental Congress, who submitted it to the people of the several states for their approval. It was agreed that when it was adopted by 9 states, it should become the supreme law of the land. Now, for the first time, there was a real national issue. The people arranged themselves into 2 great political parties, the Federalists, who believed in a strong government and the new Constitution, and the Anti-Federalists, who were opposed to a stronger union between the states. And now what keen discussions, bitter quarrels, and scurrilous and abusive newspaper articles! A bloodless war of squibs, broadsides, pamphlets, and frenzied oratory was waged everywhere. Hamilton and Madison were mere boys and visionary young men. Franklin was an old dotard and in his second childhood. And as for Washington, what did he know about politics? The Constitution was called a triple-headed monster. Many able men sincerely believed it to be as deep and wicked a conspiracy as ever was invented in the darkest ages against the liberties of the people. How eloquently did such men as Hamilton, Madison, Randolph, Jay, Light Horse Harry Lee, John Marshall, Fisher Ames, and a score of other makers of our country defend the new roof, as the people were then fond of calling the Federal Constitution. A series of short essays written by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay, published under the name of the Federalists, were widely read. Although written at a white heat, their grave and lofty eloquence and their stern patriotism carried conviction to the hearts of the people. The Delaware State, as it was called, was the first to adopt the Constitution. It was not until the next June that Massachusetts and Virginia ratified it as the 6th and 10th states. New York next fell into line in July. The victory was won. The new roof was up and finished, supported by 11 stout pillars. On the glorious 4th in 1788, there was great rejoicing throughout the land. Bonfires, stump speeches, fireworks, processions, music, gorgeous banners, and barbecues of oxen expressed the joy of the people over the establishment of a federal government. "Hurrah for the United States of America!" shouted every patriot. The good ship Constitution was at last fairly launched. The wheels of the new government began to turn slowly and with much friction. It was not until the first week of April, 1789, that the House of Representatives and the Senate met and counted the electoral votes for a president of the newly born nation. There were 69 votes in all, and of these, every one was for George Washington. John Adams was the second choice of the Electoral College. He received 34 votes and was accordingly declared vice president. Thus was formed and adopted our just and wise Constitution, which, except for a few amendments, has ever since been the supreme law of the land. This document has been called by Gladstone the greatest work ever struck off at any time by the mind and purpose of man. To it we owe our prosperity and our high place among nations.